from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Rachel Carson is credited with helping to launch the environmental movement. Her book, Silent Spring, published in 1962, brought worldwide attention to the harms posed by DDT and prompted government and business leaders to examine the dangers of pesticides. Now, a new PBS documentary is looking at the life of Carson, a woman described as a quiet introvert who took on one of the nation's most powerful industries. We learn how next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, you're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. A new PBS documentary premiering January 24th examines the writing, the research, and the unshakable conviction of biologist Rachel Carson. In 1962, Carson challenged government and business leaders and the orthodoxy of her time with her book Silent Spring, which exposed the environmental harms posed by the pesticide DDT. Carson, a biologist who grew up poor in Pennsylvania and was uncomfortable in the spotlight, challenged prevailing assumptions about chemical safety and helped birth the modern environmental movement. She died 2 years after the publication of Silent Spring, and her ideas are still debated today. Joining me to talk about Rachel Carson and her legacy is journalist and author William Souder. Good morning, William Souder.
Good morning, Mina. How are you?
I'm well. And you wrote a biography of Rachel Carson called On a Farther Shore, The Life and Legacy of Rachel Carson. Can you remind us how science and chemicals were regarded during the 1940s and 50s?
Well, I think science was part of this, belonged to this large belief that that technology was the ultimate answer for humankind, and that technology and the technological solutions could cure all the ills and address all the issues that that people had to deal with. And chemicals were an important part of technology, which included other things, of course. But the idea that there was better living through chemistry was pervasive in the 1950s and 1960s. And it was really kind of an unquestioned a belief that we could invent new products that would make our lives better. At the same time, there was very, very little awareness that there might be some unsuspected, unseen, unpredicted collateral damage from using chemicals, particularly from using them indiscriminately, and particularly from using chemicals that were designed to be poisons, as pesticides and insecticides were. And so the idea is hard to understand this now, but back if you go back to the late 1950s, early 1960s, when Carson was working on Silent Spring, one of the things she had to contend with was the novel concept that a chemical contaminant that maybe you couldn't see or taste or feel or even detect in the environment, and that you were only exposed to in small doses from time to time so that you never felt any acute effects from that exposure, that a chemical contaminant like that could cause harm over time, maybe health problems that didn't arise for years or even decades. And this was an existential problem for Carson, but also a kind of a logistical problem. How do you convince people that there could be a real threat like this when the whole idea is kind of unrecognized and foreign to our way of thinking? So in the context of this period of time where science is really moving us forward, we're beginning to explore the oceans, we're beginning to explore outer space, we've developed atomic power and nuclear weapons. In the midst of all this, the idea that you could suddenly kind of put your hands up and say, let's stop for a second and pause and think about what we're doing was both radical and was unexpected from Carson, whose previous work was completely unlike Silent Spring.
I want to actually play a clip from the documentary about Rachel Carson, the PBS documentary in which you appear. This is a newsreel from back in the day that talks about the promises of DDT.
Headlines in chemistry. And here is our first headline. Science can now rid the country of mosquitoes.
The mosquito is doomed, and so is the tiny, bloodthirsty black fly. These biting insects can now be completely wiped out by man-made fogs loaded with DDT.
Part of the... It was considered a miracle chemical in part because of its role in World War II, right? I mean, it was sent to battle zones. There were soldiers right. battling malaria, and it was incredibly effective.
So DDT, this dichlorodiphenyl trichloroethane, that's that chemical compound was discovered back in the late 1800s. And for a long time, nobody knew if it was good for anything. And then in 1939, a Swiss chemist named Paul Muller discovered that it was a very potent insecticide. It's actually a nerve poison. And it seemed to kill all kinds of bugs. And at the same time, appeared to be harmless to warm-blooded species, or at least harmless to people. And the search for something like that had been going on for quite a long time. We had very, very few tools back then to control agricultural pests or commercial or residential settings that just weren't good pesticides until the development of this whole class of synthetic pesticides that included DDT and eventually about a dozen other kind of related ones. It's really hard to overstate how important this discovery was and how eagerly everyone looked forward to the time when we'd be able to use DDT everywhere. You're quite right. It was used principally in theaters of operation during World War II, at least initially, and very successfully. In 1943, the U.S. Army was occupying Naples, Italy, and there was an outbreak of typhus. And typhus is a disease that's communicated by lice. And so the Army initiated a delousing operation in which they sprayed 1 million civilians with DDT. This is 1943. And the epidemic was halted in its tracks. And there's newsreel footage of people being dusted down with massive quantities of DDT. And it worked. And everyone understood that after the war, it would go into general use, that it would be used by the public. It would be used by businesses, definitely by agriculture, farmers, and foresters, but also in hospitals and restaurants and homes. And that's exactly what happened. By the late 1950s, we were using about 80 million pounds of DDT every year. And in 1948, Paul Muller, the discoverer, was given the Nobel Prize for discovering DDT. Sounds strange now because we understand that DDT is an extremely toxic and dangerous substance that's been banned in this country for decades, but that was not the case back then.
Yes, there were those images that I'm sure others are familiar with where you saw DDT being, you know, sprayed over kids eating lunch, sprayed all over crops and all over people's homes and things like that.
I was one of those kids. I grew up in Florida in the late 1950s. And early 1960s, and we had occasional outbreaks of encephalitis, which is a mosquito-transmitted fever that affects the brain. It can be fatal. It's certainly serious. And when those occurred, trucks would come through our neighborhood spraying a fog of DDT that traveled up the lawns and across the rooftops. And of course, when they appeared on our street, my brothers and I would run out and get immediately behind the truck and jog along in the fog behind. So, and nobody had any problem with that back then.
And as you mentioned, it's pretty amazing that Carson was challenging something that was so deeply a part of our everyday lives. The other thing that the documentary and you point out is that she irked, you know, male scientists because she was a woman.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a theme that runs through Carson's life and work and career and the reaction to her books, any woman today can tell you, is an unfortunate fact, has been an unfortunate fact of life. Going back to her time when she worked for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, she was an information specialist, very good at her job. She eventually became the editor-in-chief of the Fish and Wildlife Service. Her job was to write pamphlets and monographs and edit scientific papers prepared by the scientific staff and issue press releases and that kind of thing. And this wasn't necessarily women's work, but it was the place that Carson ended up. And she was good at it, and it was where she first encountered some questions about the safety of DDT, because the Fish and Wildlife Service had begun testing it in the mid-1940s, and they immediately found that, contrary to the initial reports, although DDT was extremely effective in killing insects, it was clear that it was actually toxic to every organism that was exposed to it, particularly to fish. It was almost instantaneously deadly to fish who might be in a stream or a lake that got oversprayed with DDT, but also to eventually, as the Fish and Wildlife Service learned, it was toxic to animals and to birds. And Rachel Carson actually wrote some of the initial press releases back in the mid-1940s, alerting people to the fact that we needed to be exercise some caution in using DDT and perhaps be more judicious in how much of it we used, because it was clear that we had a lot to learn yet about exactly how toxic it was and how it might behave in the environment.
We're talking with William Souter, a journalist and author of On a Farther Shore, The Life and Legacy of Rachel Carson. He also appears in a documentary premiering January 24th about Rachel Carson's life. Rachel Carson, she grew up poor in a small Pennsylvania town. Frequently, she was described as quiet and introverted. And you mentioned that she worked for Fish and Wildlife. One of the things that sounded like it was deeply affecting to her was experiencing and seeing the ocean after being landlocked for some time. Mm-hmm. And what I found really interesting about that description was that it really seems like it was the seeds of the idea that nature is, in fact, beyond the control of humans, that it's not something that humans can control, which was not necessarily the ethos of the time.
Yeah, I think that Carson came to recognize, and this actually was a theme of Silent Spring, and it was a theme of a number of speeches that she gave around the time of the publication of Silent Spring, that actually what had happened in the 20th century was that really for the first time, humankind had begun to regulate and control nature in ways it never had before. And this was true not just in terms of the use of chemicals like DDT, but also with respect to another technology that was developed beginning in the late 1930s and that came into use during World War II, and that was the use of nuclear weaponry. And in the 1950s and 1960s, as the Soviet Union and the United States became engaged in this fierce arms race, the testing of nuclear weapons was injecting huge amounts of radioactivity into the atmosphere, and this threatened to change really the nature of all life on Earth. And a number of scientists pleaded with our government and other governments to find a way to stop doing this testing, because they recognized that over time, exposure to elevated levels of radiation, even if they weren't immediately toxic to us, had the potential to change, to alter the human genotype, to really change our very, very basic nature at the chemical level. And so this was part of what drove Carson to write Silent Spring, because she was very concerned about the fact that we could now change the world more quickly than we could adapt to those changes. You know, living things always adapt, and life finds a way to survive as circumstances change. But that often requires time, and it often involves unpleasant results for many of the species that don't adapt. So Carson recognized that she was living in a time when all bets were off, when human beings could do things that they couldn't do before. And what she wanted to insist on was that we be judicious and that we slow down and that we not be so confident in our abilities to do something that we did it without considering what the consequences might be.
The nuclear testing is a big part of it. And I think also the moment when it seemed like the tide was starting to turn in terms of total acceptance of these types of advancements through chemistry. There was that H-bomb test that fell, the radiation ash, I guess, fell on a Japanese fishing boat, and then these Japanese fishermen were losing their hair. They were getting very, very sick. And so there was a public service announcement in 1954 following the hydrogen bomb test by the U.S. government, and it went like this.
The atomic cloud, like a giant vacuum cleaner, has sucked up dirt and debris from the earth and is full of radioactive particles. Is it dangerous? Yes, right now it is. You wouldn't want to go into it, but neither would you deliberately walk into a blazing fire. You have to use common sense.
What that clip shows, too, is just, yes, the lack of real understanding of the degree to the far-reaching effects of a test like that.
Mina, you put your finger right on it. I mean, we need to allow for some naivety, a lack of understanding. This wasn't just the government being reckless in trying to downplay the risks of nuclear testing. I think that genuinely was not understood what those risks were, how this radioactive debris could become entrained in high-level winds in the jet stream and travel around the Earth for years and settle back in rain and in snow and contaminate areas and end up in the food supply. All of that was just being discovered at the time. And so it wasn't just kind of casual, don't worry about this, nothing to see here kind of attitude. It really was, I think, kind of a genuine belief that, you know, ordinary cautions would serve us well in the nuclear age. The test you refer to in March of 1954 was an important turning point. That was a test that took place at Bikini Atoll, and there was a Japanese fishing ship nearby that was contaminated with radiation, and everyone on the ship was made sick by that exposure. It was a huge international scandal. Major portions of the Marshall Islands were contaminated, as were parts of the Pacific Ocean, in part because the explosion was so much more powerful than the scientists had predicted. That one device in March of 1954 was equal to 1,000 of the bombs that we dropped on Hiroshima during the war. And so the power of that explosion and the resulting debris and radioactive contamination in the area made everyone realize for the first time, really, that the ultimate threat in nuclear war was not necessarily the explosions, bad as they were, and as despite all the damage and the lethality of those the areas where the bombs might fall, but that the real threat was the long-term, long-range contamination of the entire Earth that could result in a massive exchange of nuclear weapons. That fallout and the radioactive contamination was really the problem, was really the threat of nuclear war. And of course, Carson recognized that she could draw a parallel between radioactive contamination, which people did understand and fear, and chemical contamination, which people for the most part were oblivious to. That was a novel concept in the late 1950s. It's hard for people to understand that now, because we almost intuitively concern ourselves with contaminants in the environment. But that was not the case then. And the idea that little exposures to DDT or some other pesticide here and there that really didn't give you any symptoms at all, if they continued over time, could accumulate and could have an effect on human health or on environmental well-being. These were ideas that people just didn't hold at the time. And in recognizing that connection to nuclear weapons, I think Carson was able to make a much more persuasive case.
Yes, I think really the time was ripe when Silent Spring came out. Also, there was that cranberry scare, right, of pesticide-contaminated cranberries was pulled from the market. So people were starting to get nervous about this.
Wow. Go ahead.
Well, I just was wondering if you wanted to talk about how the chemical industry fought back against Carson's.
Well, of course, the chemical industry realized, and you mentioned the cranberry scare. This happened in 1959, just before Thanksgiving. It was discovered that the cranberry crop was contaminated with an herbicide that had been applied at the wrong time of the season, so that there were residues of it in the cranberries, and so cranberries were removed from grocery stores all across the country just before Thanksgiving. It was a huge a problem, and it came in the middle of the early stages of a presidential campaign. You had Richard Nixon and John Kennedy, who were running against each other, going out of their way to drink cranberry juice and eat cranberry sauce wherever they went, but particularly in Wisconsin and other places where that's a major industry. That was one of the first times, I think, that the public actually did sort of sit up and take notice of a chemical contaminant and begin to wonder what else might be out there that could affect them. And I think that one of the lessons learned in that was that that concerns about chemical contaminants were a threat to the chemical industry. And so early on, I think the pesticide manufacturers, the chemical companies, realized that they were going to have to push back against Rachel Carson. When Silent Spring was serialized in the New Yorker magazine in the summer of 1962, there was a lot of pushback from the chemical industry. They put together a war chest of about $250,000, which is a lot of money back then, to fund sort of a counter-information campaign against Carson. They hired people to go out and give speeches supporting the use of pesticides or to argue against Carson. They attempted to discredit her as a scientist and as a writer. She was, and you alluded to this earlier about her treatment as a woman, they rarely failed to mention that she was a spinster, which may have been code for gay, which would have been an insult back then, or a mode of attack on her. And in the most extreme cases, it was suggested that she was somehow in league with, as one chemical manufacturer put it, in league with sinister forces from the Eastern Bloc, which is that's Cold War code for right. a communist. And the argument was that Rachel Carson was somehow in league with the Soviet Union, and that her real agenda was, in Silent Spring, was to end or severely curtail the use of pesticides in the U.S. and thereby bring our agricultural output and our economy in general down to a level closer to that in the Soviet Union, that she was really kind of working to undermine America. And so, and this is interesting and important because these are become the terms of this debate that we're still having today. This is why, and this is a question I was eager to try to answer in the book. Why do we have this argument around the environment? Why would a Republican and a Democrat feel differently about a global ecosystem that we all have to live in and stay healthy in? And yet we do have this ongoing left-right feud, this partisan feud over the environment. Well, the terms of that argument were established in the reaction to Silent Spring, and specifically when the chemicals industry and their allies in government, and they had powerful allies in government, attempted to push Carson to the far left lunatic fringe of the political spectrum, characterize her as a communist, lump her in with the organic food faddists and people like that. And you know, on the other end, you had business and government in a very tight matrix, a very powerful matrix, opposed to science and opposed to concerns about the environment. So if that sounds like the same thing that we hear today around climate change, it is. It all began around Silent Spring, and it all began in the attempt to undermine Carson.
Well, I want to talk with you more about that. We're coming up on a break, and I want to invite our listeners to join the conversation. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. We're talking about Rachel Carson and wondering, what do you want to know about her? What are your thoughts on the environmental movement and chemical regulation, just as William Sauter brought up right now? You can email your questions to forum at kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Mina Kim. More after the break. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. A new PBS documentary premiering January 24th examines the life of Rachel Carson, who challenged powerful government and business interests and the prevailing assumptions in our society about chemical safety with her book Silent Spring. It exposed the environmental harms posed by the pesticide DDT. And we're talking with William Sauter, who is a journalist and author who appears in the documentary and wrote the book On a Farther Shore, The Life and Legacy of Rachel Carson. And William Sauter, just before the break, you were talking about, in some ways, that this situation, this pushback on the chemical industry and the chemical industry's counterattack, in some ways, are you saying was a blueprint for how these types of battles would occur for years to come and that we're in now?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. As I said, one of the questions that has interested me for a long time is why we fight about the environment in the way we do. And I thought maybe I'd find some answers in the reaction and the response to Silent Spring and how people chose sides in that argument. And I think you put it nicely. It was a blueprint. It is a blueprint for the way we talk about the environment today. People are lined up in exactly the same way. On one side, you have industry and business. They're allies in government. And on the other side, you have scientists, writers, people concerned about the environment, people devoted to the environment, and very often not a lot of common ground in between. I think the discussions we have about climate change today, which if Rachel Carson were here, would see as a major environmental concern, are very similar and patterned on the kinds of conversations that took place around chemical contaminants and pesticides when Silent Spring was published. So yeah, I think that she did. Not only did Carson sort of set the agenda for us, but she inadvertently, I think, kind of provided the model for a debate that goes on and on.
Well, Ryan asks, who attempted to discredit Carson's work, individual or organizations? How and why did they do it? We touched on this already, but he also tweets, how did Carson persist? Climate science could learn. So how did she persist? How did she manage to win the day? And I mean, it is worth, I think, noting here that she wrote Silent Spring at a time when she was suffering from breast cancer. She was taking care of an adopted 5-year-old grandnephew of hers. She was the breadwinner for a mother who was, you know, aging and soon going to die. It's incredible circumstances that she's in.
Well, she was a very strong individual. But I think more importantly, Carson was living and working in a time very different from the one we live in now. This is before reporters and writers and scientists had come under attack and been demonized and discredited to the extent they have been today. Carson had a very, very powerful platform. She was a beloved author. People who had read her books about the ocean were devoted to her work, and so she was paid close attention to. But she was also confident that she was right. She had based all of her work on scientific studies and on scientific fact that she was confident in and that she believed in and was sure would win the day in whatever kind of argument and attack was coming her way. So when chemical companies did attempt to persuade her publisher not to bring the book out or to correct it or change it, or when they attacked her in public, her response was always simply that, well, I stand by what I said and I can prove it. And of course, the problem was that for her critics was that she was right. In 1962, President Kennedy, in the wake of the serialization of Silent Spring and The New Yorker, ordered his scientific advisor to form a commission to investigate the claims in that book. And when they reported back a number of months later, they essentially said, the commission said, we believe that Rachel Carson has gotten this correct, that the hazards of the indiscriminate use of pesticides that she points to, these are well-taken points, and we would do well to heed them. Now, the commission didn't have any regulatory authority. It didn't have any ability to do anything about those findings, but they did endorse them. And so one of the things that sustained Carson through all of this was that she had the truth on her side. She had facts and science on her side. So that was good. But she was also just a strong individual. And as you mentioned, she was desperately ill with cancer for the last couple of years that she was at work on Silent Spring, and certainly very ill with it in the wake of its publication. And she handled her disease with enormous grace and courage, and that just sort of carried over into the rest of her life. She was a shy, reserved woman who spent her whole life living very quietly with her mother and her cats. She was not someone who wanted necessarily to thrust herself into controversy or to get into a big public argument, but she felt obligated to do it. And this, she always talked about Silent Spring as an obligation. She felt that she could not remain on the sidelines, knowing what she knew about pesticides, and which she had been studying going back to the mid-1940s back at the Fish and Wildlife Service. It finally just became too much for her. And she told her friends and she told her editor, William Shawn at The New Yorker, I'm doing this because I have to, not because I want to, not because I'm looking for trouble, but because someone has to do this. Someone has to speak up. And people have a right to know. This was a big – this was an important theme of Silent Spring, was her belief that the American public did not understand the dangers of these chemicals, was being routinely exposed to them either through their own use or through large-scale use in spraying operations and in agriculture that spread these contaminants throughout the environment. And so if the chemicals industry hoped to scare Carson into silence or – to convince the public that she was somehow wrong because she wasn't a good scientist or wasn't an accurate writer or was some kind of leftist lunatic, they ultimately failed because she was none of those things.
Well, let's hear what our listeners have to say. Susan in San Ramon. Hi.
Hi. I grew up in the Midwest in the 50s, and we had a neighbor who had this marvelous silver box that he would put on a harness thing over his shoulder, and he would have a couple beers, and then he would go around the neighborhood, and it was called a fog machine, and he would fog everybody's yard for mosquitoes and bugs and things, and us kids would follow along behind him and run in and out of the fog and play and laugh, and it was sort of a every few week summertime fun thing that everybody laughed and had a great time doing, and I'm sure none of our parents thought that they were exposing us to something terrible and harmful, but in retrospect, I'm sure that it was. but it was just no big deal, and I think to the point that your guest made that people just, they didn't know. It was just like, great, the mosquitoes will be gone for a while, and that's a good thing, right? So I just wanted that as a comment.
Well, Susan, thanks for sharing that story.
It's a great story. And a lot of people who will remember those times will have similar stories. You know, again, by the late 1950s, DDT had been incorporated into a wide range of consumer products. You could get furniture that was impregnated with DDT. You could buy paints and varnishes that had DDT in them. You could buy shelf paper, and my mother used this. You could buy shelf paper that was impregnated with DDT and then line your kitchen shelves with it and, poison any insects that got into the kitchen that way. My dad owned a gadget, and I thought this was the coolest thing in the world. It was similar to what Susan's just described, but this was about the size and shape of a beer can, and it screwed on to mounted on the muffler of your lawnmower, and it was full of DDT, and the hot exhaust gas from the muffler would enter this chamber, volatilize the DDT, which is a powder normally, and spray a fog out across, so you could poison your lawn while you mowed it. So if you're having a picnic that night, you could attempt to keep everybody from getting a mosquito bite.
Well, Susan, thanks for the call, and a listener writes, Rachel Carson would not be on your program if this was happening today. You all have lost your nerve. Mainstream media is responsible for the population's lack of awareness, and reporters are at the heart of it. That is, reporters who lack knowledge, insight, and most of all, courage. I can't speak to whether or not Rachel Carson would be on this show today, but I can agree with the listener's point that I think all of us in the media could use a little more courage these days. Another listener comments, the first time I heard of Rachel Carson was in 1964. I attended a Future Homemakers of America state convention, and the featured speaker was some guy ridiculing a silly woman from Maine trying to undermine the farmers in Texas. That might have been the first time my interest in environmentalism was piqued, and after I got home, I got her book. So I guess in this particular case, the pushback against her did not work. Let's hear from Ron in Novato. Hi, Ron.
Hi. It just brings many thoughts back to me. I do have a question, but first, in the last 30 years ago with the facility manager of Hamilton Air Force Base, we focused on the accumulation of toxins there before the residential development took place. And at that time, Marin County and Bayview, Hunters Point, and San Francisco had the highest rates of breast cancer. But my questions really have to do with the 30 years that we've been working with HopeAndBeyond.org, where we focus on the bioaccumulation product. Mm-hmm. My question is, we have regulations for food and consumer products to protect the consumer. But these regulations have below-regulated levels of highly bioaccumulative, stored-in-body, cancer-causing chemicals that over years, decades even, will produce cancers and other disease. Why are we so politically blind to the fact that we could reduce healthcare costs an illness simply by eliminating these in consumer products.
Well, Ron, thanks for raising that. William Sutter, can you speak to how toxins are regulated today and to Ron's question?
Sure. Great point, Ron. You know, bioaccumulation is that's just a term that explains that sort of defines what happens when you're exposed to low levels of a contaminant that can be usually stored in fat tissues. So DDT doesn't dissolve in water. It's fat, but it's fat soluble. So when you're exposed to DDT or to any of these other nerve agents, these closely related pesticides that were developed about the same time, you tend to store them in your body because every cell in your body is encased in the cell membrane itself is made of fat. And of course, you have specific fat. So there's a lot of fat in the human body. And this is a storage facility for contaminants, DDT, but also other things like PCBs and other kinds of chemical contaminants. So the question is, why don't we do a better job of regulating things? Well, we do a better job than we used to before the creation of the EPA, which was formed in 1970 by the Nixon administration, largely in response to Silent Spring. I mean, the legacy of Silent Spring extended for a number of years after its publication and after Carson died in 1964. You know, we get the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act and the EPA. And the EPA took over the regulation of pesticides from, believe it or not, the Agriculture Department, which previously had been in charge of regulating pesticides. And, of course, the Agriculture Department had a tremendous conflict of interest because their constituency is farmers, and farmers were the principal users of pesticides. And so the idea that they could adequately regulate and enforce regulations in the use of pesticides was probably not a workable proposition. Now, the EPA has done better, but the EPA has its own limitations. And the principal one that we have is in the way, the conceptual way we regulate any kind of chemical product that comes into general use. And in brief, we ask the manufacturer to tell us it's safe. That is, we ask the company that's going to make this chemical to test it. And the EPA does require certain tests to be done and certain results to be verified. It's not like an open-ended question, but basically they turn it over to the manufacturer. And if the manufacturer can satisfy the EPA that their product is safe, then they can sell it. And if anyone later determines that maybe it isn't safe or has questions about it or wonders about the long-term effects that are hard to evaluate in the kinds of tests that have been done, it's very, very difficult to prove that a product is unsafe and to get it removed from general use. And there are many, many cases of this that we see this all the time where the EPA is besieged by people complaining that a certain pesticide is harmful, has already been banned in other parts of the world, and we can't seem to do anything about it. And so what happens then is that we do additional testing. And for the chemical company, additional testing is essentially a stalling tactic. It basically is overhead. It's the cost of doing business. And it allows you to keep selling a product while you are conducting additional safety tests. And if those additional tests ultimately find that there's harms from this chemical, usually it's about run its life as a product anyway, and there's a new product to take its place. And so the manufacturer moves on to the next generation. So that's a long way of saying that we have a cumbersome and ineffectual way of regulating chemicals, even though we believe more strongly that we should, as a result of Silent Spring. We just don't do a very good job of it.
And again, we're talking with William Sutter, a journalist and author of On a Farther Shore, The Life and Legacy of Rachel Carson. And he also appears in a PBS documentary out next week about Rachel Carson, who brought global attention to the harms posed by DDT and pesticides through her book, Silent Spring. Let's hear from Aaron in San Francisco. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. I'm actually calling with a contrary point of view, which is that the ban on DDT, while, in general, most of us obviously have deep concerns about pesticides, in the case of Africa and Asia, removed probably the single most effective last resort pesticide to control malarial-carrying mosquitoes. mosquitoes, which has resulted in the death of millions of Africans. And so obviously there's a trade-off, and there's questions to be asked, but I think many of the environmentalists in the United States, if their children were faced with imminent death by malaria, would have to reconsider its utter ban, and it indeed consider its use, while obviously pushing for vaccines and other options for malaria. In the meantime, millions of people are dying, and there are no other pesticides as effective as DDT. In fact, a number of African nations have asked for waivers and have begun reusing DDT in some of the most intensely malarial areas. So I think it's like a lot of questions where environmentalists don't think about the long-term impact, like ethanol, for example, on food prices and starvation in the third world. So I think that's an important question to be addressed.
Yes, Aaron, and I thank you for bringing it up, because Aaron is not alone, William Souter. That is one of the criticisms that has been levied against Rachel Carson.
This always comes up, and it is essentially misinformation or misinterpretation of Rachel Carson and of the record. I'll try to keep this brief. When the EPA banned the use of DDT, that was a domestic ban, and it stopped at the edge of the water. It was for the United States only. We continued to manufacture and export DDT for many years after that ban, including to Africa, but to other parts of the world as well. But that ban had no effect on its use anywhere else in the world. And in fact, DDT has been in continuous use in Africa, in Mexico, and in other places since the publication of Silent Spring. The malaria eradication program in Africa was beginning to wind down a little bit when Silent Spring was published for a couple of reasons. The countries that were funding it, including the United States, decided that they were kind of wasting their money, because DDT really didn't work very well in many sub-Saharan African settings, where people tend to live in small, remote villages that are hard to get to and hard to treat with DDT when you get there. DDT worked great in places like Egypt and Greece and India and even the southern United States, where populations are more concentrated, where people live in buildings, and where you can really make an effective assault on the mosquitoes. In Africa, it was much harder to do, and you had to use more DDT, and you had to use it over longer periods. And one of the things that did was that it caused resistant mosquitoes to appear. So when you poison any organism, you'll kill all the susceptible individuals, but you'll leave behind a few that, for whatever reason, metabolize the or respond to the poison in some different way and don't die, and they reproduce. And you end up producing a kind of a super race of mosquitoes that are resistant to DDT. So resistance to the pesticide was a problem. The economics of using DDT in Africa was a problem. But Rachel Carson never suggested that pesticides should be banned. And she specifically said in Silent Spring, and the people who trade in this idea that she's responsible for millions of Africans dying obviously haven't read Silent Spring, because she points out in the book that we need to use pesticides. They have real value. She doesn't want to end their use. She wants to use them judiciously, cautiously, but she wants to use them to fight human disease and in other situations where their use is warranted. If anybody wants to know more about this, I've written about this for Slate. If you go to Slate and just search for my name, you'll find a long article that explains all this. I'm sure Aaron is well-intentioned in his comment. This idea is out there, but the people who repeat it often just don't know the facts. They don't know what Silent Spring says. They don't know what the EPA ban actually did, and they don't know what was happening in Africa. Aaron is correct that DDT is in use in Africa right now, and every environmental group in this country, at least, has endorsed that use. No environmentalist is saying, don't use DDT to save human lives by attacking malaria. That's simply not true.
Well, I want to thank Aaron again for the call and ask you about, you mentioned that there was a resistance developing towards DDT and by insects. And so there are different opinions, it seems, about Carson's legacy, that did she really spawn the end of it in terms of the fact that chemical companies were moving in this direction anyway. There's some concern that her legacy may have created an oversensitivity to chemicals, things like that. And I wonder if you want to just talk briefly about what you think her legacy really is. There's even some that say, you know, she isn't really the founder of the environmental movement, that she was more, you know, she more stirred the pot of existing feelings.
Fair enough. You know, the environmental movement, like any kind of historical movement or event that unfolds over time, has roots that go far back into another time in history, and it's an extension of and an outgrowth of the conservation movement that existed before we started talking about environmentalism. But the publication of Silent Spring was a real watershed in American history. That is the point at which we begin to talk not about saving game species, for example, so that hunters and fishermen will have natural resources to enjoy in perpetuity. It's when we stop simply talking about being good stewards to the earth because it's ours to take care of, and moral purpose sort of demands that we hand over a clean and usable earth to our children. The publication of Silent Spring, we really began to worry about our impacts as human beings and our impacts through the use of burgeoning technology to alter the nature of our environment, to alter the nature of those natural resources. And so the conversation really changes and it becomes, you know, the idea of conservation is kind of nice and optimistic and hard to argue with. The idea of environmentalism is much more dire and much more urgent and much more about us, both as the victims of our own excesses and as the perpetrators. And so
does pose quite a moral – I mean, sorry to interrupt you, but just wanting to read a couple of excerpts from Silent Spring just because we've talked about it so much and just to give a sense of Rachel Carson's voice. She says things like, "By acquiescing in an act that causes such suffering to a living creature, who among us is not diminished as a human being?" So she asks a very big question about humankind itself. She also says, how could intelligent beings seek to control a few unwanted species by a method that contaminated the whole environment and brought the threat of disease and death even to their own kind? So she, you know, really poses this in these big ways, philosophical ways, as well as scientifically.
Yeah, Rachel Carson recognized that we're the species that's in charge, and that carries both a moral obligation and a hazard. And if we're not careful with what we do, we can do damage that, justice demands we not carry out, and that we can undertake risks that we really can't afford to take with our own health and well-being. So, I think, in terms of her legacy, I think those ideas that I think are pervasive in the environmental movement today are traceable to her, as are these other things I've mentioned, our attempts to do something about the problems that she alluded to.
Well, Emily writes, even as we speak, thousands of gallons of bee-killing pesticides are being sold in hardware stores across our country. We have made very little progress. Tracy writes, when I was in the third grade, there was an outbreak of head lice. The powers that be lined every single student up and dusted our scalps with DDT powder and issued plastic shower caps that we were required to wear for at least 48 hours. And then Margaret writes, I'm wondering if you know that in the Stockholm, Sweden, Östermalm, I'm going to attempt to say Swedish words. So, in the Östermalm metro station is an ode to Rachel Carson. The beige stone walls are sandblasted, revealing black stone beneath. There are figures and text, among them Silent Spring, translated into Swedish, Twist Vår. She is honored. She definitely has those who are really moved by what she did. Jack asks, it's interesting to read the last chapter of Silent Spring about the other road that points to biological technology solutions like the sterile insect technique to provide safe, effective solutions. There has been this. Is that what's part of like biomimicry when you're trying to use pheromones and other things to try to get insects to try to deal with
Carson
pests?
Carson was not in any way opposed to attempting to control pests that did damage to crops or that carried human disease. She was more than willing to retain the option of using chemicals like DDT, but she also thought that we could do a lot in terms of finding other ways of regulating these pests that were more natural, that were more targeted. It's a thorny issue. Every time it seems we have discovered some sort of pesticide control that seems exclusively targeted to that one pest that you're trying to get out of, that one class of insect that you want to get rid of. It so often turns out that there is some unexpected result, either immediately or further down the line, where some other species is also affected. One of the people that just emailed in said something about bees. Now, we know that honeybees are declining in a number of locations across North America, and pesticides have been implicated in that, particularly a class of pesticides called neonicotinoids, which have been banned now in Europe, but are still in use here. And that's a systemic pesticide. That is a pesticide that's applied to the seeds of a crop and then becomes incorporated in the tissues of the mature plant and supposedly kills only the bugs that want to attack that crop. And we now suspect that it may be also killing honeybees and possibly other harmless or beneficial species. So nature is a complicated place. It's very difficult to press down on one piece of nature without popping up another piece or depressing more pieces of the natural environment than you intend to. Targeted, highly specific pest control is very difficult to achieve, biologically or otherwise.
Well, let me see if I can sneak in one last call. We have seconds left. Samantha in San Jose. Hi, Samantha.
Hi. I'm an environmental researcher, and when I think of Silent Spring, I always think of Mark Twain's quote about a classic being a book that everyone praises and no one reads. And it's always seemed to me that most of the critical takes on Silent Spring have focused on the concepts in her book that are outdated. And I just like to encourage researchers and students to read this classic with a critical mind that asks how today's science can further the understanding of the concern she expressed.
Well, thank you, Samantha. I think that's a good way to end. William Souter, thanks for joining us for the hour.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure, and I hope everyone that can will watch the documentary.
Yep, it premieres next week on PBS. Thanks to our listeners. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.